This is the Bob McCown Podcast, and it's brought to you by BetRivers. Download the BetRivers online casino and sportsbook app today with John Shannon, who's with us from where? Edmonton?
Lovely Edmonton, Bob. Beautiful day today.
Black curtain behind him. Some baseball chatter today, but maybe not typical baseball chatter. We're not going to talk much about, I don't think, about players and positions and whatever. Alex Anthopoulos, the general manager of the Atlanta Braves, will join us. And I've known Alex for a long period of time, but we've never really talked about being a general manager, especially in spring training.
Right.
And while I used to run into him, you know, all the time in spring training, he'd be there, he wouldn't be there. He'd be on the field talking to the manager. He wouldn't be there. What the heck is he doing? Well, it's spring training, and he is the general manager of a very, very good baseball team. So what does he do during the day? You know, what's his schedule like? So we'll talk a bit about that. Alex Anthopoulos, when we come back after this. Hi, this is Bob McCown for BetRivers.com. Hey, if you're looking for a sports book or casino app, you should check out the BetRivers Sports and Casino app today. Play all of your favorite casino games for real money anywhere and anytime. Plus, get in the action with each sports game with hundreds of sports betting options. And get ready to feel like a VIP, because you'll earn both loyalty level points and bonus store points on every real money wager you make. You must be 19 plus, available in Ontario only. Please play responsibly. If you have questions or concerns about your gambling or someone close to you, contact Connex Ontario at 1-866-531-2600 or speak to an advisor free of charge. BetRivers.com. McCown and Shannon back with you, and we're with the general manager of the Atlanta Braves. Our friend Alex Anthopoulos is with us from Florida in spring training, and I want to ask you about that. You know, I can't even tell you how many spring trainings I've been to. And you always see the general manager, where do you see him? You see him at the batting cage, usually beside the manager. Who knows what the hell they're talking about? And then he's there for a few weeks and then disappears for a couple weeks. And you really don't have any idea of what, like, we know what everybody is doing, but what does a general manager do during spring training? Because there's not much, is there?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say this. At the beginning, at the outset when you show up, you can create all kinds of work, right? But sure. There's definitely, you know, I would always joke, and now that, you know, Sal Pisano, former Jays player, is on our staff. So I used to joke in Toronto, like, I don't need to go see watch Sal Pisano hit for the 10th time in a row, take batting practice. But I would say this, before the game starts, so we've, you know, there's one piece that we do that I think is pretty important is we meet with every player in camp. And that emanated from when I was in Toronto, assistant GM and so on. You're walking through the halls in spring training, you walk by players. And then, I don't know, like that night or the next day, I'd get a phone call from the agent saying, hey, can you tell me where so-and-so stands? What's his outlook? What's this and that? And I think to myself, like, the guy just walked by me. Like, why couldn't he ask me the question? Kind of ridiculous that we have to, that we're not comfortable enough to have that conversation. So from there, I decided, you know what? We should meet with every single person in camp. I mean, I don't need to tell Austin Riley, he's the starting third baseman on the team, but we should meet with every single person in camp. It takes a while. We have 66 guys starting, and just give them a lay of the land. Hey, this is, you know, you're a kid in A ball. You're here to get some experience. You're probably on the first wave of cuts. Hey, you're a minor league free agent. You're trying to make the team. This is the spot. You know, you're reaffirming what you discussed in the offseason when you signed them or traded for them and so on. And it's actually a way for you to get to know some of these guys because, you know, you sign them, you bring guys from other organizations in. And that's probably really beneficial overall because we get a lot of insights. But then beyond that, you're not making cuts for at least, you know, the first 10 to 2 weeks of games. So in theory, you know, you're watching bullpens, batting practice. I'd say you're building relationships more than anything else, but in reality, you know, if you're not here, the show's going to go on.
So does the manager make all the decisions regarding who plays on the major league team, or are you involved?
Yeah, so spring training, the manager sets the lineups with the bench coach and so on, and they'll get with the player development staff, and because they'll need guys to come over because guys are playing 4 innings, 5 innings.
Yeah.
And they're not playing daily, right? So it's one game on, off. The veteran guys, you don't want to send them on the road. They don't want to get on a bus for 2 hours, 2.5 hours. So you try to plan things around there. But I would say this, there's some things front office wise where, so we would talk about Ronald Acuña came off a knee injury last year, wasn't moving very well in the outfield. So he was right field only. And even then he struggled a little bit because he wasn't moving the same. In the past, he was a guy we could put in center field. He was a Gold Glove candidate. Now he's moving. He was moving very well before he went to the World Baseball Classic. So one of the discussions I might have is that, hey, let's try to get him some looks in center field in spring. Just so when we're constructing the roster, you need a fourth outfielder who could back up in center and so on. Now, is Acuña viable as a center field option if Michael Harris needs a day off? If he's not, well, that's going to impact, are we carrying a fifth outfielder? And how valuable and how important is it that we have a center fielder? So we might do things like that. Or I remember my first spring training, I mentioned to our manager, I'd love to see Ozzy Albies play a game at shortstop just because he had done it in the minor leagues and so on. So you might have a request or things like that, but 99% of the time, the manager's making the decisions. You are talking about who you're going to stretch out as a starter. You only have so many innings available, and you can't stretch 10 guys out to 3 to 4 innings. You just don't have enough innings to go around when you have to pitch the relievers. So those are some things that we'll talk about. So there's a lot of discussion with front office and staff, but day-to-day, the manager's doing all that stuff.
How many times have guys made the major league roster in spring that surprised you?
I'd say a few, and I tell myself every year, I have a general idea of, who's on the team.
Sure, exactly.
And I'm not going to be influenced, right? I'm not going to be influenced. Guess what? Get down here. It's all you're watching. Get influenced. Yeah. And you really shouldn't. They're small samples. People aren't game planning the way they would during the season. People aren't playing every day. They're playing, 2 at-bats, day off, 3 at-bats. You might be playing at the back end of a game after the starters and you do well, a reliever comes in. So realistically, you should really be evaluating the last 10 days, maybe 2 weeks at most. The issue is it's the primacy bias. Those guys that were awesome at the beginning can't let go of what you saw at the beginning of camp. Even if guys were late, guys are throwing hard. The position players are late with their swings. And you just remember what you saw, and you're waiting to see it again by the end of camp. So if you don't have set spots, you're ultimately going to go with performance, or you're concerned about depth. If a guy's out of options, you might give him the benefit of the doubt. You're trying to keep the best team over the course of 6 months, as much as everyone loves opening day. So now I think about Toronto. We did not go into camp thinking Roberto Osuna or Miguel Castro would make the team. I mean,
exactly. They both did.
Yeah, wasn't even a – but you get in there, you're with the coaches, they're throwing well. We needed a closer. We needed bullpen help. And, look, I think there's a part of it where there's a credibility component, right? You have to look at your coaches, look at your players, and if you're keeping someone off the team that everyone believes is the best player and gives you the best chance to win, you feel – now, if you are throwing away a player who's – is out of options or has an out clause, and you're like, look, I need to keep the depth. That's fair because it's over 6 months. But if a young player is doing that well and you have an opening and you have a team that's built to win, like we felt like we did in Toronto, and that was the offseason we had gotten Donaldson and Martin and so on. I think you owe it to them to take a shot. In the worst case, you just end up sending them back.
So for this Braves team, Alex, would you define you had some open spots for opening day?
Yeah, so I would say our fifth starter spot. So, Mike Soroka and Ian Anderson are two guys that are established. They've had a lot of success at the big league level. They're the front runners for that spot, the five spot. Look, we have some young kids in camp that are really throwing the ball well that I would have told you candidly, they wouldn't even have been in the mix on my radar, on our radar, to compete. But they're throwing so well. Their stuff looks so good that now they're part of the conversation. And look, we're going to take all the time that we have all the way to the end. And no, it's to the point where when you see these young guys doing well early, you start, especially someone who's going to pitch, you start to map out, you want to make sure it's real. So we were just talking the other night, most of the lineups that you face, if you pitch, the home team has the better lineup because the veterans aren't going to travel. They're going to play the home games for their fans and so on. So you take our young guys. Ideally, we want to try to have them make starts now on the road because they will face the better players. Now it's a little bit complicated with World Baseball Classic, but we know that if we're playing the Blue Jays, for example, or the Red Sox and so on, a lot of the stars aren't necessarily traveling to our ballpark. But if we're playing in Dunedin, in Fort Myers, there's a good chance some of those stars are going to be playing, and that would be a good opportunity to have them face good competition. So those are some of the things that we talk about. And we know what Max Fried can do, and Spencer Strider and Charlie Morton. They'll pitch on backfields. They'll pitch where they're just getting their work, and results are irrelevant. The guys that are competing, you're trying to find good competition. And the same way with relievers, you want them to get into the game as early as possible before the stars or the established players get pulled in inning 5 or 6.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to ask you that question. One of the dilemmas is, and I don't know how many fans, I guess if you've been to spring training, you know this. Even if there are 5, 6 starters in the lineup, they're probably only going to play 2 or 3, 4 innings right at the beginning. If you're a reliever especially, and you come into 4 or 5 ball games in the spring, you may be facing Class A, Class AA yep. hitters. Well, the analysis of that may look good, but it's not against major league talent. There's no formula for deciding, you know, that, is there?
No, I think, you know, and that's the
you
thing.
You have to be careful.
If you do it early in spring, your starters aren't built up yet, right? They're going 2 innings first time out, probably 3 next right. time, and 4. But, you know, 4 innings the next time out, you try to get, you know, if you have 2 or 3 relievers, you can only get so many looks. So it's definitely, so you end up relying a lot on stuff. I mean, one of the things I look at a lot, I mean, look at all kinds of data, TrackMan data, how the ball moves and this and that, but just pure statistics, just the standard statistics. I think strike throwing, you know, a plate's the plate.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's, I don't care where you are. I don't care what league you are. I don't care who you're facing. Can you throw it over the plate? And if you're walking guys, it's an issue. And look, getting hit hard, striking guys out, competition, we can look at the information, the velocity, and so on. But if you have issues with command and strike throwing, that is real, in my opinion. And yeah. That's not spring training. It's not a mirage. So, you know, I guess as I've gotten older as a GM, and maybe, I don't want to say less tolerant, but maybe less patient overall. It's hard to watch guys that the walk guys, right? Deep counts, 3-2. And I think you're always going to take guys with stuff, and, you know, guys with stuff normally will walk guys, just like guys with power will swing and miss. But, you know, especially now with the new rules and guys on base and easier to steal bases and so on, I think command and control is going to be important. So look, with that normally comes guys that don't throw as hard and the stuff isn't as good, more polished. But I do think adding traffic to the bases is going to be problematic. And I think we've done a better job over the years of shifting towards guys that could throw it over the plate. And that's something that we're going to really key in on.
What about a young hitter? Because every spring, somebody hits 400
yep.
on just about every club during the spring. So here's a young hitter who isn't starting. He's getting in late in ball games. He's pitching against, again, Class A, Class AA pitchers. Do you evaluate hitters' performance, again, based on what they do against major league pitching rather than what they do against minor league pitching in spring training?
You know, you try, but it depends. So I can tell you Spencer Strider is playing around with the changeup right now. He's predominantly a fastball slider guy. They're elite. They're really good. He was changed up 5% of the time. But this is, he knows he's on the team, so he knows he can experiment a little bit. And before games during the season, the catcher, the coaches, the pitcher will sit down and spend quite a bit of time preparing for the lineup. They'll go through it. They'll talk about it. They'll sure. have attack plans and so on. And there's a lot of work that goes into it, more so now than 10 years ago, a lot more. And spring training, it just isn't done. You roll out and pitch and throw your game and you're working on stuff. Like, you know, I was talking to guys and one of the guys that's established is I was trying to work on command of the fastball, setting up down and away. And he's just like, I think that helps with my delivery, but he's just experimenting and playing around. So position players are very tough, especially when you have a track record of a guy doing certain things. And then in spring training, they're having great springs. There's so many examples. I remember, I don't know if I was scouting or not with Toronto. Simon Pond with the Blue Jays had like 8 home runs in spring. Brad Emus with the Blue Jays had a great spring. So now some of these guys, it might be real. I remember when Alex Rios had a breakout spring training and it carried over. So I think the biggest thing is if you see a guy having a great spring, you want to see it through. Now, especially if you're going to lose the player and he's out of options, and if he doesn't make it, you have to expose him to waivers. You don't want to get burned, because if you let the guy go and he does well, you're like, well, he was doing it in spring. You saw it. So you don't want egg on your face. If they have options, you can send them to the minors. You're likely to say, okay, they had a great spring. It's fantastic. Let's see if they go down to the minors and if they continue. And if they do, we'll call them up. But, you know, I think it's very hard with position players. Now, if a guy's made a radical swing change and there's something to point to and there's a story around it, fine. Delivery change, you develop a new pitch, swing change. I'm probably buying it at that point. But if you look the same, your delivery's the same, your swing's the same, you're just getting great results, or if your body's the same, it's hard to buy into a 20-game sample. I love Edwin Encarnacion, so I could say this, but he wasn't great at third base. But there was, you could see him in a 3-game series, and I remember seeing some 3-game series at third base where he made some unbelievable plays, and it'd be a tease. And if you came in scouting and you just saw those 3 games, of course this guy can play third. If you watch him over 30, 40 games, you're ultimately going to see that that probably wasn't the spot for him. So you just have to be careful with these tiny sample sizes unless there's something to point to.
So how do you communicate that with the player? Or is that up to the manager and the coaching staff as spring training goes on to say, hey, you're on the bubble. You need to you need to do this, or you are gonna go to AAA.
Right. So that's where you have the conversation. We talk about meeting with everybody in camp. You know, this, you imagine having 66 player meetings, right? Over, and you get in, you've got 9 to 10 days before your first game. We really push to try to get all those meetings done before the first game. The reason is we don't want to meet with some guy who pitched the day before, gave up 5 runs, and he thinks the meeting is totally tied into his performance, or guy struck out three times, looked bad, and they think the meeting is. So we want to do it before they've thrown a pitch, they've had an at bat, and we try to walk them through their outlook and how things look. So if you have to have that follow-up conversation at the end of camp, hey, you had options left, you didn't make it, because we explained to them, it's not the first time they heard it. So we'll explain, look, you have options, so you have to be that much better than the next guy who's out of options. You're on a minor league contract. So we will try to the best of our ability to map out reality. And they may not like it, but it's an open forum at that time. You walk in the spring, everyone's in a good mood. No one's had a bad camp yet. So we can have an honest conversation. And if there's an issue, and look, they've got 6 weeks to change our minds and so on. But I think it's important that we're on the same page and everybody knows where they stand. And ultimately, when the news is delivered, hopefully it's that they made the team. There's no surprises. They may not agree with the decision, and you don't expect them to. And I've told players this many times, when either they're getting traded or they're getting DFA'd, we never have the conviction to say we know this is the right decision. I've told players many times, this might be a mistake. We might be wrong on you. We might have made a mistake. We might be wrong. This is the decision we're making today. Here's why. I can't tell you with conviction that we're right, but we have to make a decision. We've got to cut down to 26. And this is what we're doing. And I think players appreciate you shooting them straight. They don't like it at times. Of course, no one does. But I think you can put your head on the pillow at night. You're just straight, direct. And I don't believe in the, hey, this is awful. This is hard on me. This is really no one wants to hear that. People get let go and so on. Same thing. It's give me the news. It is what it is. The decision's been made. Be straight and have an honest conversation, and that's all that you can do. I mean, that's how I would want to be treated. I know the manager of the team feels the same way, direct and honest.
What do you think? What do you think the percentages of decisions that you've made that were really difficult, with a player, whether you send them down or keep them?
You know what, Jose Bautista, that was tough. We had him in Atlanta. Look, it was at the end of his career.
Oh, I get it.
But, that was a tough one. And it's tough because I brought him in. And, he was debating, I think, at the time between Cleveland and us, where he was going to sign. I think the major league side on Cleveland was a little higher. It's $1 million with us, $1.5 million with Cleveland. I think ultimately, I don't want to speak for him, but I think he came with us because of the opportunity. I think obviously there's a relationship, there's trust and so on. And look, so we signed him at the end of spring training. He had to go down to the minor leagues, get ready. So he was behind. And we had a young player at the time, Johan Camargo, who had gotten hurt. But he finally came back and he started playing really well. And, you know, we had another guy, Ryan Flaherty, who's coached with San Diego now, but that first month of the season, he was swinging the bat great. And, you know, we had committed to Jose to be on the roster. So we added him to the roster and he played. We honored our commitment there, but he just wasn't playing well. Part of it is he missed spring training. He was getting older. I wonder if he'd had a full spring, how much better he would have been. Now, he ended up having a solid season, ended up with the Mets and the Phillies at the end. But Yoan Camargo ended up playing. He came back and he was swinging the bat. Great power, defense. He just came on and he emerged. And I remember having a staff meeting at one point. So maybe Jose was here for a month or so or 5 weeks. And it was hit and miss and wasn't playing great. He was a great guy. But Camargo clearly was playing better at the time. And in the staff meeting, you know, I think this was my first year in Atlanta too. So I'm the new GM. I believe every coach is under contract for a year. So there's all those elements too. I think people are probably, you know they have a history with them and so on, and probably want to be careful not offend me. I don't want that to be that way, but it wouldn't surprise me. But look, it was clear, and I saw it, that Camargo was the better player at that time. He was playing better. And the staff basically said that, and no one was going to say, hey, I think we should release Batista. But I knew which way the room was going, and my responsibility and my loyalties to the Braves, you know? And normally with a decision like that, the manager would be involved and so on. But I remember Paul Beeston saying this when he had to make some changes. When I first got the GM job with him, and he's making changes with staffing and so on. And, you know, he said, it's the old Yeller theory. You're my dog and I'm going to shoot you. And I don't mean to be, you know, harsh that way, but like, you know what? I brought Jose in. It was my relationship. No one else should have to have that tough conversation. You know, that's on me. You know, so I'm like, I got it. I'm going to talk to him. I'm going to sit him down and just be honest with him, you know. But it was tough because this is a guy that did a lot for me in my career and so on. And he trusted to come in. And look, we honored our commitment. I didn't have any guilt about what we had done. If he had been playing better, we wouldn't have had that conversation. But, you know, it's the old John Hart line. Don't ever let a falling star fall on you. Right. And when you have personal connections and relationships, those are hard. So it wasn't emotional like that, but, you know, pulling him in and saying, look, like, we're going to go with Camargo. I'm going to do right by you. I can DFA you and trade you. I can outright release you. You tell me what is best for your career. Like, normally I wouldn't give the player the choice, but that's where the respect comes in. The relationship is, you tell me, Jose, what's the best thing for you? What do you want to do? And he said, you know what? He was pro. He was great. Release, the Mets got him 3 days later, 4 days later, and he played okay, ended up with the Phillies at the end of the year. But he ended up in our division with two teams in our division. But it was tough. It was tough to do that because I was excited about the potential of what he could do for us and be for us. And, you know, it's hard to do.
I'm curious, Alex, how many guys in that staff meeting that you had are still in the staff meeting?
Yeah, I think it's almost the same staff.
Wow.
The only changes we've had since I've been here, we've had, I've been here, this is year six now, so I'm going into year six. Two coaches in that span, our major league pitching coach from my first year is not here, and our major league bullpen coach from my first year is not here. But that's it. Everyone else is the same. It's the same group. It's evolved. We promoted some guys. We've expanded the staff, but no, we've kept the exact same staff, the manager, the bench coach, all of them. So I think, you know, all that being said, you do what's right for the organization. You're always going to do the right thing. It doesn't mean you're going to get it right. But like I said, you can put your head on the pillow at night and know you're doing what you should be doing.
But loyalty and stability and communication all go hand in hand in a scenario like that, don't they?
Yes. Yeah. I think stability is important. I think loyalty for me is a huge thing. And I think it is for 99% of the world. So, but, you know, in these jobs, loyalty and friendship are not one and the same. So I do believe that friends will get you fired. You know, you can't just hire your friends, right? You need people that are good and so on. And I think it makes it more challenging when there's people you have relationships with or you're friends with, because the lines get blurred a little bit and expectations change and so on. So I think you have to be detached in these positions, in these roles, and everyone will look at you and what you're doing. And you know, you want to make sure you're handling yourself the right way. And look, no one's going to come knock on your door and say, I didn't agree with you're doing this and that and the other thing, but you know that you're being watched in a good way. I know when I was a junior employee, I watched what the GMs were doing. I watched who they were hiring. Were they hiring their buddies or were they hiring the people that were most qualified? Mm-hmm. And I think it's a really big deal. And I'm big on giving people autonomy to run their departments, but I have a lot of friends. I don't hire friends. I hire people that I think are good. If they happen to be friends, fantastic. But they have to be good first, because ultimately it's from a credibility standpoint, it'll kill my credibility in the organization, even though people beneath me necessarily may not say anything, but it's not the way you should run things. So that's pretty important to me. And I think I would say the bar for me is higher with people I have a relationship with.
Alex Anthopoulos is with us, the GM of the Atlanta Braves, and we'll take a quick break and be back with more after this.
The Bob McCowan Podcast is brought to you by BetterHelp. Unfortunately, life doesn't come with a user manual, so when it's not working for you, it's normal to feel stuck. Navigating any of life's challenges can make you feel unsure, whether it's a career change, a new relationship, or even becoming a parent. As the world's largest therapy service, BetterHelp has matched 3 million people with professionally licensed and vetted therapists available 100% online. Plus, it's affordable. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to match with a therapist. If things aren't clicking, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. It couldn't be simpler. No waiting rooms, no traffic, no endless searching for the right therapist. The therapists are trained to help you figure out the cause of challenging emotions and teaching you productive coping skills. Learn more and save 10% off your first month at BetterHelp.com/Bobcast. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Bobcast.
McCowan and Shannon with you with Alex Anthopoulos, who's with us from spring training. You were talking about hiring friends. I wonder if are you extraordinarily cautious about developing a friendship, especially a close friendship with a player?
I just don't. I'd say this as a young GM of 32. I would never develop a friendship necessarily, right? But you have relationships, but I do think you have to be careful how. And even close is too strong a word. There are lines, no matter what. You're going to have to deliver bad news at some point, right? Jose Bautista is a great example. He's a superstar. At some point, he won't be a superstar. And, right. So that's why I remember Paul Beeston used to ask me, he used to walk the concourses sometime. He used to say, well, why don't you come down and walk the concourse with me? I'm like, Paul, I'm not going to come walk the concourses when things are good. And then all of a sudden, when they're bad, I'm going to vanish. And not that he was telling me to do that, but staying consistent is really, really important. So I think with players that I know that there will come a point in time that they get traded, they get released, they're not happy contractually and so on. So I think thought is to maintain a relationship that they're comfortable if they need to come to me. And then I'm available, but I'm not around. I'm not in their space. If I'm down in the clubhouse, I'm in and out. I'll pop in quite a bit, but I don't hang out, and I'll just kind of roam through and I'm available. If I go on the road, 10-day trip, I'm not going on a 10-day trip. I'm popping in for a day or two. I'm available organically. I'll take your early buses when it's quiet. I'll just be there if someone wants to settle up to me and ask me questions or has an issue with this or that or so on. The coaches, if I'm down there all the time, they think I'm spying, whether it's the manager or the coaches, they're not saying that, but I don't want my boss coming in my office, sitting on my couch all day and just sitting in my office, hanging out with me. So, and he's great, but I don't think, I'll go down to the manager's office, but I think it's important to give everybody their space at the end of the day and know that you trust them to do their job. But I also, if things are going well, I'm not around. I never go down on the field for BP. I just don't think there's any upside that comes from that. If we're not playing well, if things aren't going well, I will be around. I'll go down to the field. I'll go on the road. I'll make myself available. But if things are going well, I don't need to be front and center and around, and I'm there to support. So relationships with players and so on, I just think there's too many lines there. I do think I have good relationships, strong relationships. I think I have trust. But I by design, I make sure to give them their space and also know that there's lines.
So when you talk about making yourself available, is that as simple as walking through the clubhouse?
Yeah, but not even like just walking through the clubhouse, just kind of being around. And, you know, I remember something that stuck with me my first year with the Blue Jays. So 2004, scouting coordinator. And you guys remember the player Dave Berg? And I didn't know Dave Berg well at all, but I would travel on the road and chart games. I'd get the velocities and chart the games and so on. But something Dave Berg said to me in passing really struck with me. And to this day, we were talking about managers and coaches and so on. And he said, you know, the guys that when you're not playing, you know, when you're playing well, hey, how you doing? Everything's great, this and that. And the minute you're not playing well, they walk by you in the hall like this. And he's right. That happens a lot, right? It's the elephant in the room. Guy's not playing well. Things aren't going well. You almost think you can't talk to him. Something's wrong. You know, and I make a point of if guy's having a hard time in a bad funk, I'm not running from him. I'm going to him. That's the guy I'm going to go seek out. And not, you know, and I'll say this, Paul Beeston would do that too. You're in a 7-game losing streak. You see his phone. You're like, oh boy, here we go. And he's, you know, trying to pump you up, get you excited and so on. And I think those are the type of things that'll do because look, these guys, they're human, right? Am I getting traded? Am I going to get sent down and so on? But I will try to treat them the same as I would if things are going well. So there'll be a reason for me to check in with guys, talk to guys and so on. And you also get your finger on the pulse. I think being on the road, you have much more, you know, a sense of the team than you do at home. At home, it's busy. It's a lot of media, it's a lot of staff. There's a lot more individuals that are out there. So, you know, what I would say is I'm around when I need to be. And I believe guys are comfortable enough to come and see me if there's a question that they have.
How do you pick your road trips? Which ones you go on?
So I'm not a, I don't look at like cities or this or that. It'll be just timing, feel. If there's something that needs to be addressed, I'll go on the road. So we were in a pretty, so we, last year, you know, we had a rough start to the year. I mean, not terrible, but we weren't playing great. You know, coming off the series and so on. First two games we lost in Arizona were awful. I mean, really sloppy. It was like rock bottom. Manager had a team meeting and so on. Like, you know what? I'm going to jump on a plane and just go meet the team on the road. Like, you feel like you need to be in the fire with the team when things are going bad. You feel helpless when you're away. So I joined and I stayed. I wasn't going to stay through Colorado, but I did stay through Colorado. We started playing better. It had nothing to do with me, but it's just momentum. We're in it together, talking through things, being there, just things that have been going on. Just you're as a group that you're all in it together when things aren't going well. So I'll jump on a plane and I'll just stay for the remainder of the trip. I thought initially I'd go for 2 or 3 days. I ended up staying for 5 or 6. So just organically, it was good conversations, talking to the hitting guys, the pitching guys, some of the players. And I felt like it was time well spent. It was quality time that was needed at that moment in time. If I'm there and I'm like, look, I'm just getting in the way. I'm twiddling my thumbs. I'm leaving. And there's other things I can do. I can go see affiliates. I can go do all kinds of things. See guys for the draft. So it's really a feel thing. If things are going on or if I think things need to be addressed and it's more in person, it's not over the phone. If we have a move to make, we think we're about to DFA a player, make a change, release a player, and it's a big decision, I don't want to stick it on the manager. It's very easy for me to say, you know, the manager, hey, you deal with this when it's a tough conversation. There's times where I feel like it's a big one. I should be there. I shouldn't just dump that on him, you know? So, right. Yeah, no one's telling me to do that. It's just instinctual and feel. And whenever I even debate those things, I know what the answer is. If the thought crosses my mind, I probably should be there.
In spring training, 100% of your time is on your club, or how much do you pay attention to other clubs and particularly other clubs in your division?
You're following what everyone's doing, right? Yeah. And you know that the big thing is anytime someone's injured, it's news. But I know when we have an injury and it's all over MLB trade rumors, everyone's probably talking to each other. Wow, did you see what happened in Braves camp and so on? You're following your club 99% of the time. You're aware of what's going on around the league. But really, the injury stuff is the main thing, or if you hear someone's velocity's down. Those are probably the two things outside of your camp that would be noteworthy, that would be something that you talk about.
But the are those daily updates you'd get, or how does that work?
Just following the internet, following the news, and so on. I mean, you're watching your team daily. You know, we had a game. We had a home game the other day. I went down to the clubhouse after. We had a young guy who threw the ball well, and a guy before the day before throwing the ball well. So I just figured, you know, let's have a little fun. We had some of the coaches, and I'm like, well, why don't we have some debates? And started asking them organically, who would you take between these guys? And I knew it was going to be a split camp, so I want to get these guys riled up and get some debates and some arguments going and so on. We had some laughs, and you try to break the day up a little bit too. But talking baseball as well is a really good thing also. So you don't get to do that all the time. We're so busy. We're doing things. You don't get to just sit back like you would at a bar and just debate players and talk about things. So 99% of it is your own club.
I would imagine that there are have been players who have tried to curry your favor by getting to know you. In other words, you're on the road with the team. Maybe you're sitting in the bar by yourself. Maybe you're waiting for somebody, whatever. And a player walks in and sees you there. Like, how often do players try and address something with you?
You know what? You'd be surprised. I'll have the occasional beer, but
I know
I don't enjoy alcohol as much as other than when I was in college. But you know, I'm not a team bar guy. I probably just go up. I lead a pretty boring life when it comes to that, now that I'm married with kids. I guess I'd say this. I feel like I never put myself in a position where that could even be a factor or could come into play. So if guys are coming up to me, it might be saying, you know, is there something we can do about the start times or the buses or the, you know, it's not going to be, hey, I'm upset with a coach or a manager. I mean, that they know to not put me in that position and so on. It might be, hey, I have a friend who's throwing an independent ball. You know, could you send someone to take a look? If it's something about their performance and so on, I'll be the one to bring it up to them. You know, I might say, hey, I've noticed this, I've noticed that. And if it's the elephant in the room, I'll talk about it. So if they're coming up to me to talk about things, no, I joked about this a year ago. We're in Miami. Our catcher, Travis d'Arnaud, comes up to me and says, hey, we got an ice cream machine the year earlier in our clubhouse. Hey, can we get an ice cream machine in a clubhouse? And I don't want 26 guys eating ice cream daily. And as a soft serve, and we were going to play the Mets. We had a huge series in August against the Mets. We had lost 4 out of 5. I'm sorry. We had lost 3 out of 4. When we played in New York, or 4 out of 5, I mean, it was a good chunk. So we had a 3-game series, and we were going to face DeGrom, Scherzer, maybe Chris Bassett. But I'm like, all right, you win 2 out of 3 against the Mets, you get in the machine. It's like, all right, start spreading word. But those are type of little organic conversations. So I'm thinking, there's no, you know, not that I don't believe in our team, but it's feel pretty good about the bet, you know, and those guys are really hard to beat. I'm sorry, I think we may have had a 4-game series in 3 out of 4, whatever it was. But we won it. And our closer, Kenley Jansen, after we won the game, he starts going like this and like the line, like the soft serve machine is a high five, and like we're getting the ice cream machine. And to our clubhouse staff, the ice cream machine was there the next day. But you know, just little things that come up. You know, we had a team meeting here the other day about travel. You travel on off days. Do you not travel on off days? And just something that, you know, we had some guys and just, we talked through it. And, you know, we just talking through what makes sense and so on. I think you're treating these guys like grown men. You know, I'm 45. I don't view myself as older than them. I don't view myself in a position of authority. I just view myself that I have a responsibility. This is my job description. They have their job description. Yes, there are going to be lines, but at the end of the day, we all want the same thing. Now, you put the contract stuff aside, which is in the winter. Once we all show up, we all want the same thing. We want to win games.
But hold on, Alex, does the ice cream machine, does it do chocolate and vanilla?
Yeah, so the one the year before was just vanilla. So I said, hey, I said, we'll get you like the top of the line. and then actually Chick-fil-A, which is obviously a huge brand in Atlanta, they got wind of the story and it was a thing. So they actually like got us a souped up, like unbelievable top serve ice cream machine in our clubhouse. They got like the cups and the this and the sprinkles. And I'm not elated with it, but you know, for 2 months, if that's going to team morale, whatever you want to call it, whether it's a placebo or not, you know, it's a fun thing to do, right? It's the monotony of the season. It's long. It's a grind. You know, those are things that just come up over time.
Ice cream machines and team weigh-ins. They have to go hand in hand.
They don't go hand in hand there. But I'd say this. Our guys, generally speaking, are pretty good about things. You know, we try to have a healthy setup and so on. But I think the biggest part is it starts with the selection of the players, and that comes to us. So, you know, quality of life starts in the front office. If we're bringing in guys that are talented and so on but are not the best teammates or not the easiest guys to coach and so on, that's not good for the clubhouse staff, for the manager, for the coaches, for the players. So I think over time I've gotten even more specific about it because there's a quality of life component to it.
Well, just on that point, I would imagine that there are several times that a player comes into your organization through trade or whatever who doesn't have a personality that works in the clubhouse, that there is a problem. Yeah. Which is more important, performance or attitude?
I would say, I mean, you want to say performance, right? Because it's a performance game, results game. But I guess I'd tell you this over time, especially as a young GM, definitely performance. There's certain attitudes and so on that it'll be a non-starter. There's going to be an alternative, right? There's going to be another player who may not be as talented and so on. Now, short term, you're likely not to see the warts. So if you get a guy at the end of July and he's a free agent at the end of the year and you've got him for 2 months and he's coming into a winning environment, you're probably going to be fine. The next spring is when they'll probably start showing up. I've had that occur before. But I've walked away from a lot of talented players. I didn't early on in my career, but now, and I still talk to I was talking to one of our relievers the other day about that exact thing. When guys come from other teams, I will just grill them on their teammates and who they've been around and ask a lot of questions. And I, to this day, our guys, you know, it's flattering that say they love our environment. They love our clubhouse. And they talk about how we are specific about who we bring in and so on. But I still struggle with, do we overdo it? You know, are we overdoing it to where we're walking away from talent too often? It doesn't mean we're taking non-talented players, but there's guys that are performing at a higher level that we just don't think fit or, you know, are good people necessarily. And we walk away from them. And I still wonder to this day, you know, have I overdone it? And I check myself with our players who say, if you were a GM, would you do that? Would you take this guy? Would you not take this guy? Well, how do you think it matters? And so on. And especially guys that have been on other teams. So look, we haven't won the World Series each year, but we've made the playoffs. So, you know, we're going to keep going the way we're doing, but I'm still trying to adjust and evolve. And look, you still have to bend a little bit. If you're stuck and you have a glaring hole, you might have to hold your nose a little bit. You just have to decide it's tolerance and performance. And
sure,
if we have someone that's a little questionable, I will loop in our key players and I will loop in our manager and our coaches.
Right.
And if they say yes, then we're all in it together and they're going to work. They're going to be really invested to make it work. If they're out and they don't want it, we won't do it. I mean, there was an example, my first spring training with the Braves 2018, we had a hole in the infield, guy got hurt. There was someone who was out there on a really good contract. I brought in four of our top players. And I said, guys, you know, we have a hole at third base. We're faced with playing so-and-so, someone that shouldn't be playing third base for us at the major league level. And, you know, we could bring in a certain player but there are holes, there's warts here, you know, and you guys want to win, you want them or not. If you don't want them, you know, the warts, like, we're going to go with this person. And they all said, we don't want them. I said, okay, so we have issues or whatever. You guys, like, I don't want you to look at me thinking I'm not doing anything about it. I'm not trying to fix the problem, but we are consciously making a decision to pass on. I want to say the guy that you guys don't think will fit the room.
Well, I was going to say, so their analysis was based upon whether they liked the guy or not. Whether they thought the guy was a good guy or not.
It wasn't like they just thought maybe the way he went about it day to day, they didn't think it was going to be a fit. And look, we ended up getting Ryan Flaherty, the guy I brought up before from, I think he was on the Phillies. He had an out clause at the end of spring training. He didn't make the team. Now, he was amazing for us. The first month of the year, he had leading the league in average and so on. Now, it tailed off pretty fast come May and so on, but it worked out. We made the postseason and so on. But It worked out. I mean, they, you know, sometimes I remember at the end of 2014, I had a meeting with our coaches in Toronto, and they basically begged and implored me to get rid of certain players. And they were productive players on good contracts and so on. And I just kept thinking, these guys don't get it. I can't just go find these guys on trees, right? I can't just roll in and take X millions of dollars and fill reliever, starter, middle of the order bat, and so on. And I didn't have alternatives at the time. So, you know, the thought is, we don't care. We want it. We want change. And, you know, that's where I had my own moment where I'm like, look, it's not working the way I've been doing it. I have to make a significant change. And I just had to have faith that it was going to work out. And
did you get rid of those guys?
Yeah, we got rid of those guys. And I remember Mark Burley sending me a text. So I talked to Burley after, saying, I'm just fed up at the end of 14. I'm sick of just not getting results with talent. And, you know, we need to change something. I'm going to go after a certain type of guys. And we got Donaldson and Martin and so on and Travis. And I remember as we were making moves and signing guys and trades, and Mark Burley, I don't know if I was talking to him or sent me a text, that you weren't kidding. Like, whoa, you know, like, because, you know, I'd had enough. You know, I was just like, I'm done. You know,
no, I get it.
I don't care what anyone thinks. I don't care media, PR, this, that, like, I'm doing this. I felt like I had taken my hands off the steering wheel the last few years leading up to that point. And I'm like, I'm going to do it my own way. And if it doesn't work, I'll live with myself. I won't if it's the other way around. Like, I'm going to make a concerted effort to get a certain type of player, certain things, and I'm going to walk away from talent if it's not the right fit. And I'm just committing to this. I'm not going to tiptoe around it. You know, in the past it was, oh, I'll sign a Mark DeRosa, I'll sign a Henry Blanco and like two of 25 guys. I'm like, no, I need to really change what we're doing. And, you know, it was by design. And even going through 2015, there was opportunities to get guys at the end of spring training that would have been really good for us. We could have got some relievers that were really good, but I didn't think we were going to be a fit. You know, the owner Navarro was not starting for us. He was a trade ship. Mm-hmm. And we could have moved them for, you know, talented players, but they wouldn't have fit culturally, in my opinion. So I passed. And in the past, I would have done those deals in a second. And I stuck with it. And even over the course of the summer, as we were getting guys, you know, LaTroy Hawkins, like what he was going to bring and so on. And okay, I think we had a talented club, but I do think it was a big part of turning the team around. And I even said it, I think my last press conference as general manager before, you know, anyone knew I was going to leave. I said, I felt like I'm starting to hit my stride and turn the corner. I feel like I'm a position player who found a swing, or a pitcher who's found his delivery and able to throw strikes. And I really did. It wasn't lip service. I actually felt like I found it. I found what works for me. I've got this now. Not that we were gonna have success every year, but like I really feel like I finally got this thing solved. Ultimately, leave, go to LA for 2 years, come to Atlanta. But everything I learned, I carried over, and I was real. You know, the first things I did in Atlanta was I made a lot of changes. I wanted the defense to be better. We brought in certain guys from a clubhouse standpoint. And I've maintained it to this day with some tweaks, and I've evolved. But I would say the genesis of all this started offseason of 2014.
Listen, we got to get out of here. Time is our enemy. But this has been a fascinating conversation. I don't think we've ever sat down and really talked about your job and the things that go on a daily basis. Look, you got a very good ball club, you know, chance for another championship. We wish you good luck. And it's great to stay in touch with you. Thank you very much for taking time for us this morning.
All right, guys. Always enjoy being on.
But wait, hold on. Is the ice cream machine still in the?
No, it's gone. It's gone. I need something to dangle during the season. Things aren't going well, right? So, I mean, we did it 2 years in a row. We're going to need something else. I mean, you know, after that, a margarita machine came up, and I relented on that. Was in September. I wasn't a big fan. So over 6 months, no. But if we're getting there at the end and people need some type of entertainment to get them going and motivated and bring them together, I'll probably get an NFL.
Why the hell not?
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Just get something that's non-fattening.
Exactly.
Is the trick.
Yeah.
Listen, we're going to go. Thanks, Alex.
All right, guys.
Great
see
seeing you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
That's Alex Anthopoulos of the Atlanta Braves. Well, I enjoyed that. I don't know about you, Shannon.
Oh, no. The fascination for me is I don't certainly know Alex as well as you do, Bob, but you know, there was a time when everybody just thought that Alex did everything by numbers, everything by analytics, by statistics.
Yeah.
And I think the sense that you get now, or at least I get now, is that he's morphed because he now understands that it's more than numbers. He brought up a very, very important word right near the end of our conversation, and that was culture. How do you make sure you have the right culture? You can have great athletes, you can have great players, but how do you have the right culture to win?
Yeah, you put 26 guys in a room together, 162, well, more than that, 170 days a year. Boy, they better get along. And they're not going to get along every day.
Right.
So you got to deal with that. But generally speaking, what happens, like if you have a bad guy in the room, a guy that nobody likes, boy, I would think that would be a problem, wouldn't you?
Well, I think it's a huge problem. I think, and it becomes one of those things where you do look at talent and you weigh whether the talent makes, outbalances what the personality of the player brings.
Well, look at the Blue Jays last year, because we talked a lot about, you know, the end of the dugout.
Yeah.
You know, the Spanish-speaking players who hung out there and looked like they were having a great time. And I quite frankly thought that was good. But I think the Blue Jays assessed it and said, you know, we got to break that up. That's not a good thing. That is dividing the team.
And the problem is watching the dugout is the tip of the iceberg. It's everything
happening else. All the time.
How do you maintain focus and not distract teammates in the clubhouse? How do you do that? How is your routine more important than the guy beside you? How do you make sure that everybody's pulling in the same direction?
Well, exactly. And I also get concerned about language issues. Like I'm very concerned when a player won't or can't speak English. I must tell you, like, how do you get close to a guy who doesn't speak your language? You know?
I think there's variations, Bob, because I think where we see that is that we see players not comfortable to speak English in the media, but in the clubhouse they do.
But look at the end of the Blue Jay dugout last year. Who was there? It was all Spanish speaking players.
Well, but I don't mind that. That's natural.
I think it's natural too, but it's not great for a team. Is it?
Well, except that I do think that all of those guys do speak English and would speak English with their teammates, whether it be on the bus or on the charter or in the clubhouse.
Well, I don't know.
Oh yeah. I think that's the one thing we don't understand. I learned it the hard way with European players coming to play in North America in the NHL, was they all spoke English. It's just that when they were asked it in the media, that they weren't comfortable because they didn't want to screw up. They didn't want to make that single mistake. What's that?
That happens. Sure.
That's the classic Lost in Translation, man.
Yep. We got to get out of here. Again, our thanks to Alex Anthopoulos for joining us. We'll be back again tomorrow with something. We hope you'll join us. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.